Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dale, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Today, I'm joined by Evan Lucas, Chief Market Strategist with InvestSmart, to discuss the outlook for Australian interest rates and what this means for your portfolio and your finances. There's been a lot of focus on central banks around the world finally returning their policy settings back to more of a neutral stance, and yet recent indicators are that the Australian Reserve Bank may not be so bullish. It's easy to forget that easy monetary policy has been critical to stimulating global growth around the world, but has driven some pretty predictable behaviour when it comes to asset prices. So the RBA's stance really matters if you're not heavily exposed, or even if you are heavily exposed to interest rates via a mortgage and via substantial cash holdings. Evan, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Harry, Gemma.
So let's talk about the cash rate in Australia relative to the rest of the world and how we've gotten where we are. It's really easy to forget that the official cash rate in Australia was 7% or more prior to the GFC, but it was actually 4.75% quite late in 2011. So long after the market bottomed out after the GFC, which was sort of early 2009, and then it fell by more than two thirds. Mm-hmm. So we're now at 1.5%. What's the basis? I mean, that's a really aggressive reduction. What was the basis for that?
It is an aggressive reduction. It's an interesting one. So let's start with the core mandate of the RBA. The core mandate of the RBA is to maintain trim mean. So that's what they refer to as core inflation. Trim mean inflation between 2% and 3%. Mm-hmm. So although you might see headline inflation being above 2%, and you might see a lot of reporting on that, the RBA ignores that because it has volatile items like energy, food, etc., which do move around quite rapidly.
But not prices after a cycle.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
So they have to strip that out. So they are looking for trimmed mean numbers. Now, since the third quarter of 2015, trim mean inflation has been nowhere near it.
Yes.
So it's currently, it's getting very close. It's at 1.9%. But if you go back, so let's answer that question. If you go back to that quarter where it dropped below for the first time, if you have a look at how steep the decline in inflation was going, basically starting in around about the end of 2013, the end of basically the second commodity boom. So China finally slowed down in 2013 and inflation fell down. All of a sudden, that mining investment and that mining stimulus in inflation disappeared.
Right.
So Glenn Stevens, you're right, had a conundrum where his mandate was to make sure that he maintained inflation between 2% and 3%. So he cut rates from, as you alluded to, that 3.75-4% range, and went very, very quickly and very, very hard. He brought it down to 3.25%. Did one more and then stopped for a while, and then we got our further 1% over a period. And the last one that everybody argues is that last 50 basis points in 2016. So May and August 2016, haven't seen a movement since.
Yes.
And we're now at 1.5. So his reasoning for it was to stimulate the economy to actually see inflation start to rise back into their band. It hasn't happened.
Yeah.
And you can point to several reasons, and I'm sure we're about to discuss all those.
I'm going to ask you to point to several reasons.
Yes, exactly right. 2013 is also when you did start to see the start of the acceleration of the housing-led recovery in this country. So we were at the end of the mining boom. If you look at things like what they love to look at, which is the private expenditure numbers, that mining boom I alluded to, you can see very clearly that not only was it falling, I don't use this lightly, it was falling off a cliff. And there's always been this talk from the RBA around non-mining picking up the slack.
Yeah.
That is only just materializing.
Okay.
And only just.
Yeah.
If you look at the capital expenditure, so this is private investment and future private investment expectations, they have been really soft for a very long time. Because unlike big ticket item projects over in Western Australia to pull iron ore or gas or copper or whatever it is out of the ground, services don't require that kind of expenditure.
Yeah.
And services aren't that as transparent of, you know, cause and effect, money in, money out.
Yes.
So he had a reasoning, but you're right, we now have a scenario where rates are probably at the bottom end of what we can terminally be. We only have, therefore, you know, 150 basis points of firepower if something horrendous was to happen. In saying that, interest rates are a sledgehammer to do fine art. And I say that deliberately again, because housing has definitely been stimulated.
Yes.
They have slowed it down with macroprudential rules, so slowing down interest on it. But the issue with interest rates is that they stimulate everything or they tighten everything.
Yes.
And unfortunately, our economy probably couldn't put up with that.
Couldn't cope with either of those things. So you make a really good point. It's very easy to remember, and this is what sticks in my mind, that they're trying to control inflation breaking out above that 3%. But the idea that they're also trying to inflate the economy and keep it kicking along above 2% is quite easy to forget.
No, that, like, you've just hit the nail on the head. If you know, do go back to your university theory, is that the central bank's biggest, biggest fear is not necessarily inflation, it's deflation.
Yeah.
Because how do you get an economy out of deflation? It's a downward spiral. You're trying to basically catch a falling knife in some argument, in the fact that you as the consumer can see that tomorrow what you're going to want to buy is actually going to be cheaper again.
Of course, so people
So you postpone consumption. So it's, you know, that theory was always possibly also another argument around what's happened, why rates went so hard, so fast down, because it's a central banker's literal nightmare is trying to catch.
They're trying to avoid it.
Yeah, but we didn't have deflation.
Mm.
We had disinflation, which is that inflation was there, but it was declining. So unlike deflation, where you actually genuinely have prices going backwards, prices just weren't growing at the same rate that we've seen in the past. So all of that's there, but you're right. But the interesting thing is that it's not the only thing the RBA concentrates on.
Mm.
I mean, if you look at their 1959 mandate, it is very much around the idea that they have to also look at things like employment, they have to look at maintaining the overall economy.
Mm.
But that isn't what causes them to pull the trigger.
Yeah.
And that needs to be put out there very clearly.
Manage incredibly carefully. So we find ourselves in the situation where rates are at historic lows, and they have been for a while, as you were saying. Other economies, the Reserve Bank or the Federal Bank is looking at increasing rates because they're trying to normalize them, saying, look, we've given you all the stimulus you need. You can go on your own now. We'll take the training wheels off. It just doesn't seem like that's happening here.
Yeah, so the RBA is as neutral as you can get. So it is so wedged on the fence, it's not funny.
But at a low rate, right?
At a low rate. Mm. So it will point very clearly to the fact that, you know, growth is reasonable, and it is. But as we've just alluded to, inflation isn't there.
Mm.
Employment is pretty interesting in the fact that employment growth has been really good, but wage growth is terrible. So it again gets back to inflation.
Yes.
So it's on the fence. It doesn't have the legitimate reasons to move it. The interesting comparison, as you just alluded to, is other central banks.
Mm.
If you want to talk about that, the only central bank in the world that is actually genuinely talking about raising rates is the Federal Reserve.
Right, in the US.
So you could possibly point to what's going on with the Bank of England, but they are on the fence, not really moving.
Okay.
The Bank of Canada, similar scenario.
Mm.
The ECB, which is the European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan, which are the second and third largest central banks on the planet.
Yes.
They are still so dovish, it's not funny. So they have negative interest rates in some of their products.
Right.
Or their lending rate is 0.01 in Japan, or it's 0.012 in the European Union. So they are moving away from quantitative easing, what we saw with the US.
Yeah.
So they are starting to tighten up.
Mm.
But overall, they are still a long, long, long way down the unconventional monetary policy path than where we are.
Right.
But you are right. We have a very low base to come from, and going lower will make things harder again. But we don't have to be involved with our market probably as much as some of the other banks do. So the next question, therefore, and I'm sure you're going to ask me this.
You can ask it, it's fine.
Is basically, are interest rates as arbitrary as a central bank moving them up and down? And the answer is no.
What's the real impact for people? So this point that you're making is that, so the Australian RBA, they are giving us quite clear indicators they're not in a rush to increase rates. Let's call it that. Not in a rush. Can take their sweet time.
Patience.
They've got a lot of patience. Very patient. But also, and it is good to hear that, because a lot of us hear the US is raising rates. The impact on the Australian dollar is going to be fairly dramatic when the US has a much higher rate than we do.
Yep.
Particularly given that that's sort of seen as the global currency. But we're not getting left behind, so to speak. So you're making that point.
We're not getting left behind. What will also happen, and the reason I want to sort of really point out, that the central bank is not the only thing for you as the investor, whether that's in housing, whether that's in equities, whatever it is that you're doing.
Business lending.
Business lending. personal lending, your credit card, etc., that in the end, your interest rate is not tied solely to the cash rate.
Yeah.
It's tied to floating markets.
Yeah.
So the bank bill swap rate, which I'm sure everybody has heard about for other reasons, unfortunately, of late, the overnight rate, which is basically for one night to put it at the RBA, is now at a level we haven't seen since 2011. So it's 59 basis points the RBA is going to charge you to put your money with them. If you have a look at the bank bill swap rate on the 90-day, it's now at 2.09%.
Okay.
That is expensive. You can't get around that. So that is what the banks have to, basically the rate that they are charged for funding through the RBA.
Right.
So it might be at 1.5.
Yeah, it says 1.5.
But they are paying basically 59 basis points above the cash rate. Now, that is not that big when you look at it at 2.09%. It doesn't sound that impressive. I mean, you can get better interest rates on a term deposit. That's fine. But when you put the word billion next to that,
yes, yeah,
all of a sudden that funding is very expensive.
Yeah.
And therefore, that has to be looked at from an expense point of view from the banks. So my argument at the moment is that the Federal Reserve is actually the one driving all this. So you would have heard of LIBOR, so the London Interbank Over, et cetera, and Euribor and HIBOR, all those ones, they're all experiencing the same thing because US cash rates are going up. Therefore, credit markets and swaps markets and interbank markets are following suit.
Right.
So it's becoming more and more expensive. So if you do hear people talk about, and I love talking about this, funding rates and the wholesale funding market getting incredibly expensive, this is what it is. This is what's driving it. So we can talk about the cash rate to the cows come home, but what is likely to hit you is out of cycle rate rises because of these markets. And you already have seen in the last 18 months, the banks have moved business lending, they've moved interest-only loans, they've moved investor loans, they've tried to stay away from owner-occupier.
Yeah.
But mark my words, they will hit them.
That's interesting. So one of the things that you and I talked about offline, and I find this a very important economic statistic, not least because I didn't believe it was true when I first heard it, but at its peak, Australian property borrowers, and that was both investors and owner-occupiers, 40% of loans across Australian banks were interest-only. And 40% of loans are not just for investors, right? 40% for owner-occupiers as well.
Yep.
That is an astonishing statistic.
It's an astonishing risk, isn't it?
And when you consider the fact that those people are were financing at incredibly low rates, so both the RBA rate, but also the bank funding rate was lower at that point in time as well. So they're funding at very low rates and they're paying interest only. They will start to roll off at some point. So we all know that the maximum generally that you can get at interest only is 5 years, and banks are trying to tighten up a little bit on some of those areas of their books. And one of the Australian banks had 50% of their book at interest only.
50%.
Just astonishing. They'll start rolling off and all of these people are going to have to start paying back the principal, so that's a substantial increase in your cost, particularly when you're coming off 3 or 4% as your interest rate. So you factor in your principal. But in addition to that, you're saying probably higher rates as well, because the rates are drifting higher irrespective of what the RBA is doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't say it possible. It will happen.
Right.
It will happen. You can't escape it. So the RBA will all of a sudden find itself being pointed and fingered at going, why haven't you done something? Which is why some of the more bearish people and those that are slightly contrarian say they should cut rates further. It's not that. They are going to get hit by the fact that the banks have to fund their loan book somehow. Now, they do most of it through term deposits, which is you and I investing your money, getting your rate, whatever it is, 2 and a bit, 2.5%. That is then used by the bank with a margin on it to then lend to these people we're talking about on the home loans, business loans, etc. But unfortunately, there's not enough money to cover all that loan book, so that's why they go to the wholesale market. So yes, I am fully aware that this will happen, and you are seeing it, and it has happened. So I know I can say it with so much confidence because it has happened. It's more, the interesting thing is that you've got to look at a loan book the same way you look at a bond. So if there is risk in the market, if we do see a slowdown in GDP, if we do see not just wages but unemployment start to creep up, which is not expected, but if it did, so people starting to lose their jobs, the risk in that credit market gets bigger and bigger. So you can see the banks are trying to be prudent now to try and force people over why things are relatively good, to refinance their loans, to give them better owner-occupier loans with P&I so that they can actually afford to go across. Because yes, you are paying higher, but at least you're paying the principal off. It de-risks.
You're acquiring some equity.
Exactly, and it de-risks the bank's book as well from the possibility that all of a sudden there is a crunch. So my biggest thing is the RBA is trying to do an incredible balancing act. It is doing that by sitting on the fence, as I said.
So they're balancing themselves.
They're balancing themselves.
As much as the economy.
But I think what you're going to hear more and more and more about, and the guy I would really point to here is actually Guy Dobell, the deputy head. He's in this financial services, financial markets area. And you can hear that he is clearly talking about it as loud as he can without creating panic, saying, please be aware that we are very aware that financial stability and financial markets are moving in a way that will create a tightening effect anyway, outside of what we do.
Irrespective of our choices. That's a really, it's a really fascinating point. So if we extrapolate from that to how it flows into the share market, how it flows into the property market is obviously pretty interesting to think about. People have to pay more off their loans. If they had not anticipated that, there may be some stresses, let's put it. But it also, one would assume, be a bit of a dampener on consumption and demand.
Yes, it's also a dampener on loan growth and lending books. So if you want to look at it from a pure markets perspective and the ASX really in a whole, it is why there are questions around the six banks, not just the big four, but the six banks. Barring the stuff that's going on with the Banking Royal Commission, it is, you have a scenario where you've already seen the slowdown starting. So Sydney and Melbourne are clearly slowing down. Brisbane's just starting to see the same sort of effects. We know that how apartment blocks have already been doing that. So loan growth is slowing. So cash earnings and net interest margins, the metrics that you look at for banks, are going to see and should see a natural decline, or at least a sort of a slowing of the rates that we've seen since 2013 from the housing-led recovery. So that is 26% of the ASX. So if you look at Macquarie, the six banks, that is 26.5% of the ASX. And that is a substantial amount. And most people's portfolios are very heavily weighted towards that. So you are going to see a natural decline when the banks finally don't meet expectations or tell the world that actually your dividend policy might have to change, or actually we don't see high single digit growth next year. It's going to be mid to low single digit growth. And with headwind risk, mark to forward looking beasts, that's going to hit them. And I think you've already seen that. I think there is, not talking about any of them in specifically, but you've seen the decline.
Yes.
We've had a bear market in a couple of them.
Yeah.
And a couple of them get there and just move away. So that is being priced in terms of where you look at it. You then also, as you said, the consumption side is the next question. Is 60% of the take-home wage at the moment goes to what they call the basics, which is basically living. So that's household consumption of products, so food, blah, blah, blah. Energy, health, education.
Yes.
So those four now make up just shy of 60% of your take-home packet. Doesn't leave much for everything else. That includes paying your home loan off. That includes running a household. That includes getting that whatever you want. That getting whatever you want is the first thing to go.
Yeah. Okay. So that's quite interesting for stock pickers to look at then.
It is. And I think that's the next question people have been asking is the discretionary side of the market. Is everybody's been threatening that it's Amazon and the big disruptor that that would be. I think it's more economic than that, that if there was a slowdown, that's where we'd be. Again, there are other sides of the market that I'm actually quite bullish on because they have always got consumption in them. They've always got upside in price. And I already alluded to it, that's health.
Yeah.
Because everybody always needs healthcare and it is supported by public funding. But yeah, you can certainly point to financials and discretionary having a little bit of a tough time over the next 18 months.
Evan, thank you so much. Incredibly helpful. And in our previous podcast, you did talk about where your funds are currently allocated. So anyone who's interested in knowing exactly where Evan's putting his money, you can go and listen to that one. You produce regular updates and commentary. Where can people go to listen to that content to find out more about what your thoughts are?
So all of my content is on the InvestSmart website, but all you need to do is just go type in investsmart.com.au. I'm also on social media. You can find me on Twitter. I love having Twitter discussions. I'm on LinkedIn as well. All of it, or again, put it through the InvestSmart website. And by all means, please write in. I'm always looking forward to respond to these kind of things.
Fantastic. We also publish a lot of InvestSmart content on our website on NabTrade. Evan, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Gemma.
As always, thank you so much for joining us as well. We always love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.